Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, serving the MSU and Oakland University communities with personal and business financial services, including checking and savings plans, loans, mortgages, and online transactions, insured by NCUA. And by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, supporting more than 1,100 businesses in the greater Lansing area for more than 110 years. Information at lansingchamber.org.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us here for Tuesday, August 13th. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. You can also email us, and we've got a lot of great feedback here, especially recently, it seems, currentstate@wkar.org. Later this hour, Joe and Randy Plant, two Michigan guys who are just back from Europe, where they visited the gravesite of Joe Plant's father, who he barely remembers. From, I believe Grover Plant, if you've been following this in the Lansing State Journal, Grover Plant died in the waning days of World War II. So his son Joe barely remembers him. His grandson Randy never met him. He wasn't born until 15 years after Grover Plant was killed in World War II, April of 45. But they both visited the grave, and it has, as you can imagine, it has stirred up a great deal of emotions. They've learned an awful lot, and they visit us later this hour. Michigan's recycling rate is the lowest among Great Lakes states. At 20%, the state's rate is 10% lower than the regional average. Many throughout Michigan are hoping to change that. Back in 2012, Governor Rick Snyder identified increasing Michigan's recycling rates as a priority for his administration. Here to discuss what a comprehensive recycling plan might include is our first guest, Karen O'Brien. Karen's executive director of the Michigan Recycling Coalition. Welcome to Current State, Karen.
Well, thank you, Mark.
Let's first of all talk about the Michigan Recycling Coalition. What does your group do, and who are your group's members?
Right. So we are a statewide nonprofit association for recycling professionals. So anybody who really provides services, recycling services, around Michigan generally has something to benefit from our organization. That is haulers, material recovery facility operators, municipalities that contract for recycling services, and really any kind of business that has anything to do with recycling, whether they recycle in their business or they use recycling services outside of their business.
How does it break down in terms of commercial people versus governmental
folks?
Yeah,
it's really half and half.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Michigan has a lot of municipalities that are out in front in recycling, but it's also got a lot of businesses that have invested privately in recycling operations here.
Mm-hmm. The green economy.
The green economy.
That's right. Michigan's recycling rate is lower than most of our neighboring states. That's the $64 question. Why?
Why? And, you know, it's even lower than the 20% that you talked about at the beginning of your program. We're estimating that it's about 14.5% right now, our recycling rate. And, you know, that's with a bottle bill and that's with a yard waste band. So we're really not recycling very much. And we believe it's probably access to recycling opportunities around the state that's part of the problem. And it's also the culture. We need a significant culture shift to get people to really participate in those recycling programs.
See, that's I think some people will find that amazing. I find that a little amazing. 14%. Every time, you no doubt have met people who are diligent recyclers, and they go Saturday to the recycling center, and they're surrounded by people that sometimes you have to stand in line before you can get to the recycling bin that you want to get.
You know, that's right.
Put that in a little bit better perspective. 14% sounds anemic.
And, you know, certainly the Mid-Michigan area is served, the city of Lansing has great recycling services. We've got single-stream recycling, which means that, you know, a resident can put really anything plastics 1 through 7, bulky plastics, 5-gallon jugs, milk cartons, that kind of stuff into your recycling bin, and it all goes and gets separated out at the recycling facility. But most of your listening area have maybe drop-off facilities to go to. And that means that they do have to store it in their garage and then take it, you know, once a month probably to the drop-off center. But it's not convenient. And if it's not convenient, the majority of people are not going to do it. So we need to make recycling as convenient as garbage collection at the curb.
And how do you propose we do that?
Well, you know, it's going to take an investment in infrastructure around the state to make sure that our residents have access conveniently at the curb or at least very close to their home. It's going to take education to help people understand the real value of recycling to Michigan's economy and its environment. It's going to take market development to help businesses see that there's the commodities here in Michigan that they can get very cheaply that don't have to be transported very far to produce new products.
And how does the recycling system currently work in the state? Is there a great deal of standardization, or does it vary a great deal from community to community?
Yeah, that's the real problem, is that it varies a great deal from community to community. And it varies because each community kind of has a different take on it and different resources available to them to make it work. So more of the densely populated areas have better recycling systems simply because they've got the wherewithal and the resources to do that. But as you try to service more of those rural populations or those less densely populated areas, you know, it gets more costly to service them. So we have to get, you know, a little more clever about how we provide those services.
It's fun. It's almost an interesting study in marketing. You know, you think of being environmental, being green, recycling. It's almost an interesting look at what is in demand and what is not in demand as well.
That's right. And there's kind of two different things to talk about there. One is in changing people's behavior and to encourage them to recycle. We really have to project messages on a very statewide basis that are emotional, that get to their, underlying thought processes to help them see that, you know, it really is just a decision. You put that, you know, pop bottle into a garbage can or a recycling bin, or is that one that goes back to the store? Really helping them to understand the flow of materials, and that if we can simply move our garbage to the recycling bin, we're not only saving ourselves the cost of landfilling that stuff and maintaining that into perpetuity, but we're also then creating a commodity if we can recycle that, and that commodity has value in our state. So if we can help people make that connection, then they're more likely to do the right thing with that, you know, end of life product.
As far as raising awareness goes, Karen, what kind of is it clear what kind of messages have worked in the past?
Well, the Keep America Beautiful organization on a national level did that Crying Indian campaign back in the 70s. It was litter. It was very, it made quite an impact. And they've just undertaken a new kind of recycling campaign with the Ad Council. And it's based, you know, it's I Want to Be Recycled. So it's this little pop bottle or tin can that aspires to be something greater. The tin can aspires to be a bicycle. The pop bottle aspires to be a pair of jeans. So it's really helping people see that, you know, our waste today can become, you know, useful products tomorrow if we do the right thing with them right now. And the Michigan Recycling Coalition has undertaken a statewide campaign called Recycle Michigan, and it's really just helping every community in Michigan recognize that they can be a part of Recycle Michigan by providing those services to their residents and attracting new businesses to their area to process and manage these materials, and that everyone prospers from it. It's a win-win.
A win-win-win.
Right.
I've never heard of that. But Karen O'Brien is Executive Director of the Michigan Recycling Coalition. We're talking about recycling in Michigan and how to boost the rate. As we mentioned, Governor Snyder is making recycling a priority. A comprehensive plan is being put together to increase the recycling rate. Where is that discussion right now, in your view?
Yeah, so a couple of years ago, the Michigan Recycling Coalition put out a report, and we really did identify the value of recycling to Michigan's economy. And we said that if we could get to a level of 50% recycling, that means an influx of $500 million annually to Michigan's economy, just in the value of that material alone. If we can get it out of the landfill into the recycling stream, $500 million annually. And that's before you do any value-added processing or manufacturing. So it's very significant in our economy. And so we got the government to hear us. And we're involved in conversations with the DEQ director, Department of Environmental Quality director, and other stakeholders. And we're reviewing right now a whole series of initiatives that could be put into place. You know, there's it's not ready for prime time yet, but this is the most movement we've seen in recycling in the last 20 years.
Well, it appears you've done something of a cost-benefit analysis, or I believe it's your group that has done a kind of a cost-benefit analysis. You just alluded to $500 million in economic gains possible, and you are proposing a $75 million cost for changes to the state's
Correct.
Recycling policy.
Yep.
So that would appear to be a no-brainer if your numbers are anywhere near accurate.
Yes, yes. We think so, too, and that's why we think we've got the governor's attention on this. And we think that there may be policies out there for us to consider that even lowers that cost. So there really is a great opportunity we have before us, and Michigan residents simply need to participate in the programs that are already out there or ask their communities to provide those programs. You know, there's really no reason that we collect waste at the curb and can't collect recycling at the curb, especially if we can do something better with that materials at the end of their life.
Now, are you a resident of the Lansing area, or do you live outside
the
area?
No, I am a resident of the Lansing area.
Okay. And you alluded to a pretty good recycling program in the city of Lansing right now. Can you tell us any more about what you see in our area with regard to the recycling effort?
Well, you know, the city of Lansing, like I said, does have an excellent program. The city of East Lansing and MSU are also very good programs. Outside those areas, though, you can have very different programs offering very different opportunities, and none is very standardized. If we can begin to standardize and add infrastructure and capacity to this area, then we will be able to increase the kind of services that we have, both curbside and drop-off, and collect more and more material. Recycling is really dependent upon markets for the commodities that we collect.
Yeah.
And so we have to make sure that if we're going to collect polystyrene cups, for example, that there's an end market for that polystyrene. And, you know, DART in Mason is actively working on developing, you know, new end products for that material. And, you know, when those end products, you know, reach the market, we've, as consumers, have to buy them so that we, you know, keep that demand going. But it really is the demand.
Beyond the access issue, Karen, what's not getting recycled that we could stand to be recycling just a whole lot more?
Oh, you
is
name
there,
it.
give us the top two or three on your list.
You know, we're very lucky in Michigan. We have a bottle bill that has us collecting aluminum and polyethylene, which is the, you know, number one bottles, pop bottles. But those materials go into a different stream, so to speak. So they're not benefiting our material recovery facilities, and it's not balancing off the costs. But we really could be recycling so much more. We've got a lot of plastics 1 through 7, that could be recycled at a much greater level. Paper, cardboard, really anything that you imagine. It's really households getting on board, new households getting on board with recycling.
There are seven different kinds of recyclable plastic then, with the little triangle and the number in the
middle. Right. There's actually more than that, because each one of those have a little bit different, heat processing or pressure processing. And so it's really important that those get separated out. And it makes the recycling system very complicated. And that's why you see us moving towards single stream recycling systems, where you put everything in one bin, and that one bin goes into a truck and gets compacted and taken back and separated at the facility and not at the curb. It's just too time intensive, and you can, if you have a single stream recycling system, you can infinitely add materials to that if you've got a market for those materials. So they've added, kids play stuff, kids play plastics, tables and chairs and that kind of thing.
Bulky plastics. The plastics gets very complicated.
Yep.
I mean, we're up to seven. Sometimes it's hard to read the little numbers if the colors are wrong, and it's like, hold it, do they take three or do they take six, or what is this? It seems to me that could be simplified quite a bit.
That's right. And with single-stream recycling and with these advanced material recovery facilities, they really want to take that burden off of you. You know, if it's plastic and it's clean, put it in the bin. We'll figure it out on the other side. Because now, the contamination, the stuff that they can't recycle, they'll turn into some kind of fuel somehow. So we're really getting clever about how we deal with our waste. We're working hard to help companies on the front end see the waste that is produced at the back end and help them reduce that waste when those products are in design. And so we're reducing waste, we're recycling waste, and we're dealing with our waste more effectively on the back end as well.
And what might the average person do? What single thing would you recommend the average person do that would give us the most bang for the buck and really accelerate recycling in Michigan?
Simply participate in the programs that are available to us. And if there's not a program available in your area, talk to your community leaders and make one happen. We've been educating kids for 20 years about recycling, and so this new generation really has it, and they're going to demand these public services. And if our communities aren't offering these kinds of public services that get us to the future that we want, they won't be living there anymore. That's what we got to do.
Karen O'Brien is the Executive Director of the Michigan Recycling Coalition. Nice to meet you, Karen. Good luck.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The issue of wolf hunting in Michigan is taking a new turn. You may recall that back in March, the Keep Michigan Wolves Protected Coalition submitted some 255,000 signatures in a bid to overturn the law passed by the Michigan legislature that put wolves on the list of game species. The Senate soon passed another law that essentially circumvented the petition. Now the group is trying again with a second referendum drive. This time the president of the Humane Society of the United States was in Michigan earlier this week to lend his support. We spoke with President Wayne Pacelli about the issue. He told us that protecting wolves would not just be an ecological boon for the state, but also an economic one.
When you think about the tourist dollars that will be generated by people going to the UP to be in ecosystems where wolves live, that's a driver of economic activity. And then I think you'll see savings because we will have fewer deer auto collisions. And then you're also going to see farmers benefit because the crop farmers are not going to have as many losses because the deer population will be checked by the presence of the wolves.
And current state will continue to check in on the wolf hunting debate as events unfold. This segment and the segment on Michigan recycling is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. For more news of the Great Lakes environment, you can check out greatlakesecho.org. A new book by Mid-Michigan author Lori Nelson Spielman is getting some buzz. The Life List is a novel that explores the relationship between a mother and daughter and taps into the dreams and goals we have in our youths that somehow get lost with time. Spielman spoke with WKAR's Melissa Benmark about how her career as a teacher started to lead her down the road to writing.
My day job was and still is, I'm taking a leave of absence, but I work for the Lansing School District. And like my protagonist in the novel, I'm a homebound teacher. So when students are ill, mentally or physically, then I go to the house or the hospital and teach them.
Had you done any writing before this book?
I had. Actually, part of my job, when I first took on the homebound job in 2000, was to teach expelled students. And so I started making up little vignettes for as part of their English credit where they would read a little story and then have questions to answer. The stories were kind of, they were socially controversial. So we could discuss it, discuss their answers and talk about that. So I started writing those and then I took a class at LCC through, the first one was Linda Peckham, whom I adore. And took several of her classes and others to Dennis Heinrichsen most recently. So that's kind of when I started writing again, was at about 40. I wrote a young adult novel and another women's fiction, only collected rejection letters on those. So I was very excited to actually have this one published.
And so it sounds like it's really taken off. It's being translated into a number of languages. I heard the word movie rights come up.
Tell us about that. It's been just incredibly exciting. It has sold in 16 countries, so it's a little surreal to think that someone in Bosnia might be reading my book. And also, the film rights did sell to Fox 2000, which is extremely exciting, but the odds that it will ever actually get made into a film are still small. I'm still very excited about it.
Absolutely. What surprised you the most about the writing process and maybe even the post-publication process?
Well, I knew that it was going to be difficult to get an agent. That's the biggest block for most writers, the biggest hurdle. So it just requires sending out really upwards of 100, sometimes more, query letters, which is just a one-page letter that's pitching your story. So that wasn't a big surprise. When I first started writing, it was a surprise at how very, very difficult that is to break into. It's a very hard world to break into. And then the second surprise, I would say, is once the book sold, is how long it takes from the sale date, which for me was March of 2012, to actual publication, which was just July 2nd of 2013. So it's a lot of time, a big time lapse there. And my parents would say, you know, the book is finished. Why can't they just print it? But there's all the cover design and copy editing and lots of steps.
In the book, The Life List is something that's written when the main character is a teenager, and it really comes back into her life when she's in her 30s. How much do you think we really change as people from our teenage years to adulthood?
Well, that's a good question. I think as teens or younger women, we have big dreams. And I think that's a great thing. But sometimes I think in our adolescence or early adulthood, we something happens and we lose a lot of our confidence. I used to work as a guidance counselor, and I would see young girls come in to see me their freshman year, and they had big dreams of what they were going to do. And then over the 4 years, often something would happen. They would, I hate to say it, but sometimes it was a boyfriend or something that they would connect with, and then they would just kind of lose their big dreams. And it's heartbreaking sometimes to see how people's dreams change.
Well, and I've heard that there's some scientific studies that have said what happens to our 13 and 14-year-old girls.
Yeah.
You know, that they change, that, for instance, I mean, the one I'm thinking of was one that tracked math progress, which went very well and sometimes even better than boys, you know, even though that's traditionally
right.
Not thought to be the case. And then sometime around 13, 14, and just, like, something happens.
It's very strange, but it does seem to be that way. I think for a girl, so much is based on the way she looks and rather than how accomplished she is. And that's very sad. And they often become the girl or the woman that a man wants them to be instead of maybe who they really have the potential of being.
Well, that was one thing I really liked about your writing is that you're dealing with a very beautiful, accomplished, smart, powerful woman as a main character. And yet some of the scenes in which she's doing the lifeless things are very embarrassing and painful for her. And sometimes it's hard for those of us, and I say this with pride, who plant ourselves firmly in the geek corral, you know, to identify with beautiful, accomplished women. But I found the writing to be so sympathetic in some of the scenes where just painful stuff was going on.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I didn't want her. She has had a privileged life up until her mother dies and leaves her this list to accomplish. So, yeah, I wanted to do exactly that, make her have to step out of her comfort zone and do things that in some cases are humiliating. So I'm glad that resonated with you.
How do you feel about the labels women's lit or chick lit, especially in reference to your own books?
That's a great question, Melissa. I don't have a problem with women's lit or women's fiction. I think that really is my audience. I don't have a problem with that. I like reading women's fiction. Chick lit, on the other hand, sounds a little demeaning. And I know, you know, there's a lot of websites and blogs out there where people really wear that label proudly. I like to think that the life list has a little more substance than just a complete fluff chick lit book. But, you know, that's for the reader to decide, I guess.
Another thing that sets your book apart is that, you know, some people write about climbing Mount Everest or, you know, saving the world through wizardry, insert obligatory Harry Potter reference here. You talk about doing something that everyone can at least think about doing, which is making a life list and living up to it. Now, do you find that when you do these events that everybody wants to share their life list with you?
I have had some readers write in, and it's really, that's very gratifying when, like, I have a young reader in New Jersey who has written me several times. And she has read the book and completely taken off on her own life list. I mean, she's starting to check off things, and she keeps me updated. It's very fun to see that. But at my events, I give out life lists so that people can make their own. I am a believer in lists and life lists, and I think that if we don't kind of plan for our lives, life often takes control of us. Even the day-to-day things, if I don't write things down that I need to do, it just slips away somehow. But for some reason, when I've got it on my calendar, I can check it off, and it seems like those are the things that I actually accomplish.
I'm not positive. I think the word life list actually comes from birders.
I think it does, too. Yes, it does. I think they have, could be wrong on this, but I think it's the birds that they want to see.
Right, the ones, yes, that you've seen over the course of, and
exactly,
they've considered each accomplishments. You know, if you have this certain rare bird,
right,
on your life list, it's,
yes,
it's an accomplishment that you actually saw that bird in person.
I've seen that too. So, and I like that you brought that up. A lot of people will use the phrase bucket list when they say, talk about my book. And I'm certainly no expert on life lists, but I think there's a difference between a life list and a bucket list. I think of a life list maybe as something that we do on the way up, like you're a blueprint for your life. Big things, like in the book, she wanted to have children or be a teacher. Things that can't just be checked off, whereas a bucket list would be more, I think, things that you maybe aspire to do on your way down as
yeah,
you see that your time is running out. I still want to see the Grand Canyon, and that's just my take on it. I know people use those terms interchangeably.
So now that you have a successful book, I'm sure you're sick of everybody saying, so what's your sophomore effort going to be? But what's your sophomore effort going to be?
My sophomore effort, you know, and there is that sophomore curse.
Right, right.
So I am struggling with this. Last summer, I spent almost the entire summer writing what I thought might be my next book, sent only the synopsis to my agent, and she just said, nope, too dark. I've sort of been pigeonholed, I think. They want the same type, kind of the romantic comedy, some heft and some lightness. So I'm back to square one. We just came up with an idea, though, that my agent liked. She pitched it to my editor, and so now I just need to sit in my chair and start writing it.
Laurie Nelson Spielman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Melissa. It's been a pleasure.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And right now, Current State's book reviewer Scott Southard offers his take on The Life List.
I never liked the book description, women's fiction. It is the literary equivalent of the pink aisle in toy stores. No boys allowed. The funny thing is, I've yet to see a book described as men's fiction. But I'm assuming it would involve fast cars, loose women, and a lot of laser guns. I can't help but think that this idea of women's fiction is based on outdated gender stereotypes. And as a father of a little girl, I find that separation disappointing. It is 2013, people. Yes, my daughter plays with dolls and princesses, but she also can wield a lightsaber, pretend to be a monster, and make a mess just as good as any boy I've met. Many times, the themes in women's fiction deal with, not surprising, love, but also with finding meaning, discovering oneself, all things guys have to grapple with too, the human experience. These are books that don't take place in any fantasy land, but in our reality, making the better ones feel that much more possible. Local author Laurie Nelson Spielman's The Life List is categorized by the genre of women's fiction, with even a quote on the cover emphasizing that point. But I hope that doesn't scare anyone away. What the book actually is, for both genders, is a fun, insightful, and sometimes very moving book about self-discovery. And yes, this dude was moved by moments in this book. Brett Bollinger's mother has just passed away. Brett assumed she was about to inherit her mother's successful business, but her mother had other plans for her. Inspired by a list of wishes that Brett created while as a teenager, her mother has come up with an alternative to what Brett thought she wanted. Through her will, her mother forces poor Brett to check off the uncompleted entries on that old list before she can inherit the fortune. And Brett has only 1 year to do it. Some of the points seem easy to do, like get a dog, while others sound daunting, even for those with not having a fortune on the line, like fall in love and have a baby. Oh, and she also needs a horse. The Life List is a book made for a long car drive or a day at the beach. And while it is fun with some surprises, there are some pretty emotional passages in it as well. Brett is grieving her mother throughout the book, and she experiences the different stages of it. Also, some of the people she meets are going through hard, painful times of their own. One of the sad lessons Brett learns is you can't save everyone. Luckily, though, there are a few she can help along the way, including herself. One of the impressive things Spielman has done in her debut novel is create a very realistic character in her heroine. By the end of the story, you will feel you know Brett. She is a friend, someone you can call, or at least she feels that authentic. Through the book's wonderful personal narration, you feel you vividly share Brett's experiences as she deals with each of the points on her life list. And while the ending feels like something you would see in a Meg Ryan, Tom Hanks film from the 90s, you don't begrudge her that happiness one bit. It's that kind of heartwarming book, and you will cheer Brett on, I promise. Sometimes we all need happy endings, I guess. Even us guys. For Current State, I am Scott Southard.
And Scott's the author of two new novels, A Jane Austen Daydream and Maximilian Stanforth and The Case of the Dangerous Dare. His writing on a variety of topics can also be found online at sdsouthard.com. His blog is called The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard. And you can catch author Laurie Nelson Spielman at a book signing event tonight at 6:30 at the Delta Township District Library. You're listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Last week, our next guests returned from the journey of a lifetime. It's a trip they thought they would never make. U.S. Army Private Grover Plaunt of Mackinac City died in Germany a month before the end of World War II. That was April 12, 1945. He was laid to rest in a military cemetery in the Netherlands. Last week, two of Private Plaunt's descendants, his son Joe of Muskegon and Joe's son Randy of Lansing, became the first relatives ever to visit his grave in Margretten in the Netherlands. Randy Plaunt describes the trip as cathartic. Both men say they were overwhelmed by the hospitality and gratitude of the Belgian people who opened their homes to the Plaunts and drove them to some of the battle sites where Grover Plaunt saw action before his death. We're delighted to welcome Joe and Randy Plaunt to Current State. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Randy, I take it this trip was your idea?
Actually, it was my wife's idea. We met our friends from Belgium through Facebook. It was through an eBay transaction that occurred, and my cousin, who was friends of the person that was selling this item on eBay to our friends in Belgium, asked if flowers could be laid at the grave. And I saw this picture posted on Facebook of this man laying flowers at my grandfather's grave.
Oh, my.
And I became friends with him. And that kind of got the ball rolling from there. And my wife started communicating with him, my wife Lisa, and made the trip possible.
And when did you decide firmly, yeah, this is a trip we've got to make?
I think about 2 months ago. I think I called my father and I said, hey, how would you like to go to Belgium?
So you knew where he was buried?
We did,
okay.
Yes.
Okay. And Joe, I take it you never thought you'd actually see your dad's grave.
That's right.
This must have created an awful lot of anticipation.
It did.
Over the last few months.
It did. A lot of emotion, you know.
Sure, knowing you were actually going to see his grave,
sure.
Assuming that you had never were going to do that.
Yeah.
Randy, tell us about the main stops. Where did you go here?
We actually traveled most of the route that my grandfather traveled with the 740 Daredevil Tank Battalion, which he was involved with, which is also an interesting story in itself. He landed at Utah Beach in November of 1944, traveled through France, and saw some battles through France, but it was in Neufchâteau where the memorial to the 740 Tank Battalion sits in the center of town. They freed this village, and most of the fighting that took place in his Sherman tank as a driver started in that village in Belgium. So we traveled his route from Neufchâteau all the way down through Chevron, which took us through many parts of the Netherlands and Belgium.
But he died in Germany?
In Germany. So about a month before the war ended, the Battle of the Bulge was over, and we can only speculate as to why he continued on. It may have been to help free some concentration camps that were still active. We just don't know. That part of the story is still a mystery.
Who were these folks, Joe Plaunt, who were these folks who let you stay in their homes? And once again, tell us a little bit more about how you connected with them.
Well, I connected with them through Randy, but it was Fred and Ann
Mousset.
And I don't know, you know, you can travel the world over.
It's tough because these people were very gracious.
Yeah. A lot of hospitality there.
Well, they put us up in their homes in the Ardennes, their summer homes, and took us everywhere for free, no charge. And it was many miles of travel that this tank traveled that my grandfather drove.
How about that?
So my father's very grateful
for
these people.
So he was in this battalion. Randy, you're reading a book right now, which is all about your dad's or your grandfather's battalion. The Daredevils.
Yes, the 740. My grandfather probably was in camp in Fort Knox in 1944 in March, and was just regular Army training, boot camp. He went on furlough, and when he came back from a furlough, they decided that they wanted to make a special group, a special tank battalion. So these guys were quarantined to the Arizona desert, and it was called Area X. Sequestered is probably a better word because they weren't suffering from anything, but they were sequestered to this area in the Arizona desert. And started out with 300 men, and they discovered that 300 men was a handful. So they narrowed it down to about 105 men of the best, which included my grandfather. They practiced shooting, and their mission was to be one step ahead of the enemy and to be a better shot. And so that was their goal during training. So he left for the English Channel in July, and it was November 1st that he started his trip through Europe.
Randy, you never met your grandpa. You weren't even born until he'd been dead for 15 years. And Joe, you barely remember your
dad,
right? What kind of guy was he from the stories that you've heard?
As far as anything I've heard is that he was just a terrific guy.
And you have a keepsake you were telling me about.
I did have, when he on his last trip home before going overseas, he had brought me a stuffed kangaroo. Wasn't large, but it and anyway, there's a kangaroos are, they have a pouch and they have the joy, carry their joys in there.
Yeah.
And so this thing had two little joys in there, and I had that for several years.
But that remained one of the possessions that you had that was really one intimate link with your dad for quite a few years. Did he enlist?
No.
Oh, okay. Describe seeing his grave for the first time, Randy.
It was very, as we said, cathartic, but also the welcome that we received from the director, from Mark Gratton, was incredible because we were the first to visit, and when we told him that, he rolled out the red carpet for us. He basically locked the office and walked us to the grave with a flag. And what they do is they take a bucket of wet sand, and because the name is engraved in what I assume is ivory, they rub the sand on the name so it darkens the name and you're able to read it, take a picture.
Yeah.
But he personally walked us out there, and there's 8,832 men buried and 65 acres. And it was General Patton who said, if you're an American soldier and you died in Germany, as my grandfather did, you were not going to be buried in Germany. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. purchased this property in the Netherlands, and that's where these soldiers are buried.
I'm just trying to imagine what that must have been like approaching the grave as you saw it. And you kissed the grave several times?
Well, my father kissed it three times for each of his sisters who could not be there. One has passed away, and two are still here. And I was trying to document this on video, but still be there for my father, so I had my hands full. Because he was very emotional.
What has your sister's response been to this whole trip?
Oh, they're very excited. They can't wait to get together.
Now, are they older than you?
Yeah.
Do they they have better recollections of your dad than you do?
Well, yeah. My oldest sister is. Gotta think. She's 4 years older than I am.
Okay.
And the next sister is a year older than I am. And
have you learned a little bit more about your dad from them?
Oh, well, not necessarily from them. I think the trip over to the cemetery was a real education to be able to travel the trails where Dad was.
Oh, I can only imagine.
And Fred was so knowledgeable of the World War II in that entire area. And I mean, he could drive us through the countryside, and it just seemed like every crossroad you came to, there was a memorial for some company or some division,
And Fred was the Belgian man that you befriended.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
You get the impression that there's still for all the decades, there's still a great deal of awareness of what happened in World War II.
And gratitude, because we were part of a three-day reenactment that Fred gets involved with every year. There were 500 men, all Belgians, speaking French, with 300 restored World War II military vehicles at a camp where we spent 3 days. And we were the only two Americans that were true Americans. These Belgians were acting as Americans. So if we saw a vehicle, like a half track, and I think I mentioned, wow, that's really cool, Fred would look at me and say, would you like a ride? And the next thing I know, we're in a military vehicle riding through the countryside.
Oh my gosh.
And we were just given just incredible welcome through that whole experience.
How many photos do you have of your dad, Joe? Are there many or not many?
I think I have two.
Oh my gosh!
I have one that it's his military picture taken at, I'm assuming, boot camp.
Yeah. Okay.
And then I have one other picture that, as a matter of fact, it's the only picture that I've ever seen of him and my mother together. You know, and but that's all I've seen in the 71 years that I've been around.
Yeah.
You know.
What tell us more about these sites were well maintained.
Oh, extremely. That cemetery at Margretten is absolutely immaculate. It's maintained by a large crew. It's incredible the amount of labor that goes in. I mean, you can imagine 64 acres, and there's a pond. There is a flag with a bell that sounds every hour. And the memorial in Neuf Chateau, that's still just immaculate.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge for us there was is they spelt my grandfather's name incorrectly on the memorial. They spelt it with a C instead of a G, Grover. So I don't know, about a year ago, contacted the mayor of Neuf Chateau to try and just get them to engrave the C into a G, and we had a huge communication problem. So with our friends through Belgium and other contacts, we're going to get that changed.
Did you get the impression that that younger people, some number of people that you must have met, were born after World War II?
Well, during the reenactment, the few that could speak English, everybody had a story about how they were affected during that time. And the best story that I heard was, I guess you would call him a silent objector to the war. I don't know if that's the correct term, but this person from Brussels was forced to work in a Volkswagen camp or manufacturing place in Germany. And his way of objecting to the fact that this war was going on, he was in charge of the turn signals. He purposely wired the turn signals backwards, hoping that it would cause a collision somewhere down the road between a couple of Germans, you know, or a couple of Nazis, maybe. I don't know. But there was everybody had a story about how they were affected by that.
And do we know how your dad died?
Yes.
He operated a tank.
Right.
He was the driver.
Okay.
Yeah. And his tank got hit by a armored
AT fire.
Yeah.
Anti-tank fire.
Yep.
Okay.
And the Shermans were very thin. They were not like the Panzers or the Tigers that the Nazis had. They were referred to as tin cans. So he burned alive.
Yeah.
Once the anti-tank fire hit the tank.
Yep.
Was there any opportunity or interest in going to Germany? That's where he died, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Halver was not that far away. Halver's a very small village. If you Google Earth it, you'll be shocked as to how small that is. So it puzzles me that there was actually a war or a confrontation that took place in that small village where it took my grandfather's life. But I think we will go back and go through France and probably ultimately end up in the location.
How exciting.
Yeah.
But you are forced to try to imagine what his last days were
exactly.
Like in Germany.
Well, his company had traveled up through the northern part of Germany, and Halver was one of the communities that had been under German control. And there, I think, if I recall, in the book that Randy's reading, there was about a half a dozen small villages along that route that the 740th Tank Battalion moved through and recaptured, took all these villages away from the Germans and freed those people again.
Sure,
you know? Yeah.
And it wasn't, there was a lot of German people that
I think when you talk about World War II and Germany, always comes up, and I think that Germany has always been the bad guy, at least to us Americans. And but there were a lot of the German soldiers that didn't necessarily want to be part of it, mm-hmm. but they didn't have any choice. They were told that that's what they would do. As a matter of fact, we visited a cemetery that's maintained by the German army. And over in Margraten, where my dad is, there's one soldier to every cross that's in the cemetery. Mm. In the German cemetery, they have these small crosses. There's three names on the front and three names on the back. So it means that there's six soldiers connected into that one grave.
My word. Yeah. What was unexpected about this trip? What surprised you when you took this journey?
What surprised me was being able to travel the same area where my dad did.
Okay.
When Randy said he wanted to take me over to Margraten, I was with the impression that it was going to be a trip that was going to take us to the cemetery, but that was going to be the extent of it. I never once dreamed that I would be going down all these roads where my dad had traveled. Matter of fact, the home that we stayed in with Fred and Ann, he told us that, and he looks out across the valley and you see Chevron. That's one of the communities where my dad's battalion was. And he said my dad could have traveled anywhere from where that house is today to all the way, I guess it'd be north. It could have been about a 5-mile trip north, mm-hmm. you know. So, but that was the most intriguing and unbelievable
thing. To retrace
thing, you know?
His steps. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think the gratitude of the people, that just amazed me. It overwhelmed me.
Mm-hmm. And you must feel somewhat more connected to your grandfather after this.
I feel more connected to my father and my grandfather.
Okay. Joe, do you feel like you know your dad better?
Well, yeah, and I think that there was a lot of questions, you know, that I've thought about over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, you know, I could never find out a whole lot about where he had died and where he was buried. Originally, he was buried in Germany, and it wasn't until the statement came from the higher commands that there would be no American soldier left in Germany after the war. And so all of these, all the soldiers that were buried in Germany, in cemeteries in Germany, they were all moved either to Holland or I think they have about 8 different cemeteries, mm-hmm. you know, France, England, Brussels or the Margraten area, you know.
Okay.
And my dad, because of the area associated with Halver, not being too far away, his body was moved to Margraten.
It has been fascinating to share these few minutes with you. Welcome back home. Joe and Randy Plant just back from the Netherlands, where they visited the grave of their ancestor, Grover Plant, originally of Mackinac City. Thanks, guys. Appreciate
it. Thanks, Mark, for having us.
Thank you, Mark.
Quick reminder, current sports, Al Martin of WKAR Radio will be taping his first edition of Current Sports TV this Thursday at 6 p.m. You can be in the studio audience. Get more information at WKAR.org. You've been listening to Current State. This is 90.5 WKAR. See you tomorrow.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, alumni enrichment, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. Alumni.msu.edu.